Martina Anderson is a Sinn Féin MLA from Derry. Her career has taken many twists and turns, from IRA volunteer to figurehead of Sinn Féin's Unionist Engagement Initiative. Currently a junior minister in the OFM-DFM, she joins me now. Martina, thanks for coming on the programme.
Thank you for asking me.
Firstly, I want to talk about your past and your time in the IRA. Why did you feel violence was the route to go down then?
Well, becoming involved at that time was a difficult decision. That said, I lived in a city, Derry, a gerrymandered city, as people would have recalled at that time, whilst and still we have a predominantly nationalist Republican population. It was ruled, the local council was ruled by the unionist population. Just such was the way the voting system had been operating at that time. My father was a Protestant, and he had a very different experience and a very different upbringing from my mother as two people when they were growing up. But even when they met, like, there was no conflict at that time, but there would have been still a bit of, I suppose, a bit of a tension by virtue of the fact that he married a Catholic. We lived in a Protestant parliament for a Protestant people. I had no relationship with the state at all growing up in the Bogside. My earliest memories at the age 7 was when Sammy Devaney, a father at that time, who was beat up by the RUC and subsequently died at 9, Bloody Sunday. I can just close my eyes and I'm back there in St Mary's Chapel with my mommy crying and holding my hand and me asking questions as to why I lived and still live in the area where a lot of the shooting had taken place.
Did the fact that your father was a Protestant, did that not maybe make you bit more cautious about getting involved in violence?
Well, you know, war is a terrible thing. Let's not pretend. But, you know, people who have become involved and decided to become involved in the armed struggle did so born out of the conditions that we were experiencing. And, you know, it had nothing to do with this sort of view that has been propagated, that the war's origins lied in some kind of age-old dispute between, you know, religious bodies. And that some way that the British government was the peacemaker, you know, successive British governments told the story around the world and told it to embassies and medias and everybody else that would listen to it. And it was a story that propagated their view about their generosity, their fair-mindedness, wedded as they were to the principle of democracy and peace. I can tell you, for those of us who lived in the city of Derry and in the Bogside, and for those of us who lived in the north and had experienced the wrath of the British government and its policy in Ireland, that was so far removed. And even last night, if you listen to the programme in Spotlight and just look at the way the state that was there to uphold and protect its citizens in terms of the RUC and Operation Ballast, and how the state had become colluded and involved in a war. So, you know, we lived through all of those terrible conditions as they were at the time. And therefore, I realised at an age, a young age, 16, 17, 18, as I was growing up, I believed the state was not returning. I believed that in terms of inequality, as I said, I had no relationship absolutely at all, no relationship with the state, with the RUC, who had been there to uphold what was happening within the state. The British government was a foreign government who we didn't elect. The British soldiers who were on our streets, I constantly asked why, were people from another country. And I was a young child growing up, and you were asking questions and not getting any answers. And then I came from a household that was constantly raided. I have a big connection in terms of a family. I'm the second youngest of a family of 10. I've watched my brothers and sisters trying, attempting to get jobs, and my daddy even being hurt at the fact that when they would go for job interview, that known by the very virtue of the fact that they would answer about where their school was located, was going to reveal the fact that they were Catholic, and therefore that they wouldn't gain employment as a result.
So how did that make you feel?
Well, there was systematic discrimination and inequality, and it was quite evident that all of that was taking place. Now, as a young person growing up, you just felt that there was so much wrong happening around you. You were asking questions that no one could really answer you with any kind of logic that was going to satisfy you that it was okay not to do anything about the conditions that you were living in. And therefore you felt that you had to, that you had to try and correct the wrong that was happening. And
do two wrongs make a right, though?
Well, I mean, you can apply that to any war. And if you look down the telescope of history, you know, it has been a common story that's told in many places, you know, whether it's a war in Bosnia or a war in Iraq or, you know, in any of the wars that have taken place, that people should be denied their self-determination. And, of course, you know, in terms of the British government, for their own good, of course. And the British government marked us down in the annals of history as people not able to govern ourselves. All of that was absolutely patent nonsense and an insult. And I think that in terms of the passage of history and where we are now and the amount of pinch yourself moments that many of us have lived through because for so long we were fed this propaganda that it could never be any other way, that we needed to be governed by this outside force because we were incapable of governing ourselves. We were incapable of getting on with one another. And indeed, you know, we've made, as other people have said, we have made the impossible possible. And we are in a place where now the two parties that people felt would never be able to sit round the table and work with one another based on our common humanity and the common experiences that we share within our community are making decisions about people's lives here in the North, and we're doing it collectively together. And, you know, we have to address the hurt and the pain that's there. No community, no tradition has got a monopoly of hurt and pain. I have carried too many of my friends to the cemetery to know what those families that are going through even to this day, and we still have a lot to do to try and heal as a community and as a society. And as I said, war is a terrible thing.
At the time,
not pretend. It's how you get out of that and how you build up reconciliation and move forward. And I know you want to talk about our past, and I'm hoping I've given you, you know, an adequate enough view of my own personal experience and where we were and how it was for all of us. But despite having spent the time I spent in jail, 13 and a half years, and all that, others that have gone through much, much worse than I, you know, it's about our future, and that's what we should be focusing and concentrating
just
on.
Focusing on your time in jail for a second, how did that affect you as a human being?
As a human being, I was put into an all-male prison on remand. There were 600 men, and myself and Ella Dwyer were the only two women in Brixton prison on remand. And we were subjected to daily strip searches, 5-6 countless strip searches every day. We were isolated in a wing. There were men below us. There were men in the yard all around us. When we would go out to exercise yard to try to get some air, which you needed to do, you needed to get out of the building for a half hour. And the abuse, you know, the commentary that we received going around that yard was just, you know, unspeakable. You would not repeat it.
What was the authorities' reasoning for putting you in a men's prison?
Well, they said that they didn't have a female prison secure enough to house us, which was nonsense. They had a Holloway prison, which we could have been held in, and we were not. But again, you know, we believe it was all part of what they viewed as the punishment for being arrested in England, and this was their view of trying to make sure that they had a few in jail, or they had a terminology in jail that would say to us, we're going to break you, we're going to break your spirit, we're going to have you coming out of here as two destroyed human beings. And so therefore it was like 13 months of a battle. We left there after receiving life at the Old Bailey, and we went to Durham Prison, and Durham Prison has got a wing in it where there is a wing that's held at houses women. And to be honest, in my naivety, I sang from Brixton to Durham, believing that because there would be more women in the environment that we were going in, that we were going into a better, some kind of a living environment where we could survive a lot easier than what it was in Brixton, because it was quite tough. And I went into Durham jail, and I must say that I didn't speak for about 1 week. And I realised after a week when I was in cleaning my teeth one morning and I looked in the mirror and I could see shock in my eyes. I realized that I had been in a bit of a shock and I needed to bounce myself out of it, because Durham Prison was like the wing that we were in, the hitch wing, was like the one flew over the cuckoo's nest, only it was absolutely serious. Many of the women should have been cared for in mental institutions. They were cutting up, they were slashing up, and there was one particular woman who every day thought she was going to be hung at 4:30, and she would get hysterical every day, and many of them were on tranquilizers, and of course you would have been able to get tranquilizers yourself more than you would have been able to get a fitment. And I thought that I was put into an induction wing of a hospital, and that I was going to be moved out of there and moved to a prison, only to discover that obviously that wasn't the case, and that was it. So in terms of my time there, I went to prison. I had no qualifications. I left school like many, many other children of my age in the city that I came from and many others around the north with very little of any qualifications. And if anyone had have said to me that I had got any kind of academic ability in me, I probably left school believing that I hadn't. So I applied myself to, there was a couple of hours of education you could do every day, and I utilized my time in that way, and I came out of prison with first class honors. And I also did some Buddhist meditation when I was there as well, and that helped in terms, I think, in just keeping one's mind focused and just keeping one in touch with oneself and trying to grow and develop, and trying to help as many people as I could in the jail, because the jail, as I say, a number of the women had committed horrific, horrific offences. I had to blank out in my head why many of the women had come to the prison and deal with them as they were coming through the door, because many of them had experiences, and you talk about as human beings in terms, you know, had experiences in within their homes, that they may have children to their fathers, to their brothers, to their uncles, you know, just having experiences in life that I had never heard of, had been probably shielded from or protected from. And it's not to say it didn't happen in the north, because unfortunately we know it did. But I was, it was a world that I had not been exposed to at all. And many of the women came into jail broken, and many of them were in need of help. And whilst I had no psychology degree or no experience in any of those fields, just based on what any of us would have done in those situations, you try to do your best to help people who were struggling.
And how did you manage to not become broken by the experience? How did you get through?
Well, education was of help. I have to say, you know, I was probably one of those quite lazy teenagers and a younger person at that time growing up. You know, I never did any training, or I never did much sport or anything like that. But I ended up, I started to, Ella would have been, you know, quite interested in keeping herself fit. And so we would have been out in the exercise yard, and you would have got a 30-minute exercise. So we started to, you know, jog around one way for 15 minutes and then jog around the other way for 15 minutes. And we just continued to sort of try and keep ourselves fit in that way, that in whatever way we could. And you got access at that stage, it was once a week, to a sort of a gym. And we would have went to the gym, you know, would have done education. I was very keen on trying to see if I could just develop the skills and the tools that I wasn't able to do so before. And there were that many people around you, you know, struggling, that, and it almost became dependent upon us, you know, to help. That there was that as well. You knew you needed to help so many people, or try to, and so far as one could, because we were in jail ourselves, let's face it. So we were, you know, we just did our best. But I suppose, like the other women there, you know, it was the thought that says you're right that was keeping us going. And in terms of our struggle, having a little bit of a distance from it, and you almost become an observer to what was going on, because when you would hear of offence, sometimes it would have been after the offence, the Irish news that was sent over daily by my family, you always got it a day late, and the news that you would have received would have been a day late. So there were things that were always like a little bit of history attached to everything, and you were that you were receiving. But, I mean, that's what kept you going. And someone's in these situations, and I think any of us would be the same as human beings, we find the mechanisms within us to survive, and we do. And thankfully I did, and came through it. And I don't know in terms of any mark that it's left or not, but, you know, I think I'm quite a grounded and rounded individual.
Moving on to the present then, and since 1998 and the agreement that you and your party supported, Northern Ireland does still remain within the UK. There are still British forces here, MI5 are stationed here. So from a Republican perspective, why are the armed Republicans today not justified in their actions?
Well, you know, conditions have to exist for armed struggle, and whatever you sort of just read out there about, you know, that litany of things that you think is in terms that are still in existence, the Good Friday Agreement have given both of the aspirations to, whether it is to remain part of, as you would call, the United Kingdom, or to be part of United Ireland. You know, the Governance of Ireland Act, the policy that partitioned Ireland has gone. In terms of political equality, and whether it is Sinn Féin or any party that one would be voting for, having that, you know, the Protestant Parliament for the Protestant people is gone. The Orange State is gone. All the conditions that existed at the time that created the armed conflict is gone, are gone. And therefore, I think that as Republicans, we're very long-headed. And this is bit by bit, and this is incremental steps. And we strategize, and we use tactics, and we assess where we're at. And if anyone can say to us, you know, if your things haven't changed, I think it's absolute, with all due respect, you know, just nonsense to say that they haven't changed. They have changed.
Well, there's no doubt there has been huge reforms within the state, but isn't the risk, though, for Republicans that the more and more nationalists become settled within the system at the minute, maybe the less they want to change it?
Well, I mean, that's what you regard as a risk. I don't. I see it as an opportunity, because I see it as an opportunity. The more people start to reflect on the society that we're in and start to say, how come in this world of a few million people, why do we need two health systems? Why do we need two education systems? Why do we need two agricultural systems? You know, why can we not look at the scandalous waste of public money around the duplication of the administration of all of these services? And why can we not be coming together? And let's face it, whether you come from the unionist tradition or not, or you go to England and people will ask you, are you Irish? You go to Europe, you go foreign, you go on your holidays, and you ask, are you Irish? You know, because we all live in this land, and I believe we have more in common with people, say, for instance, in my own constituency in Derry, much more in common with Donegal than we'd ever have with London, much more in common with people in Dublin and elsewhere. And that's obviously in terms of the context that there has been, you know, there's two different states, and there are two different systems in place. But, you know, the Good Friday Agreement, you have the All-Ireland Ministerial Council, you have ministers, and I've been at the plenary sessions where ministers have been coming together in that field and having conversations about the kind of decisions that need to be taken for the benefit of all of the people who live here. So in the radiotherapy unit in Alton Galvin Hospital in Derry, you know, you have a situation where people from Donegal, and you have two ministers coming together, the A5, disgraceful decision of the Irish government, it once again ignoring its own constituencies around the northwest, and making sure that they only spoke in the wheel that's not attached to Dublin in terms of the northwest, that they're a failure to put in the allocation there. But you can see from the executive that we've decided to still keep the northwest in the A5 as a priority. So, I mean, there have been decisions that are made, and, you know, there are plenary meetings, as they call them, where all the ministers come together. There's sectoral meetings where the two health ministers or the two finance ministers will be coming together to be talking about and making decisions on an All-Ireland basis. So the world has changed fundamentally. Now, that's not to say that God knows that we still don't have a lot of work to do. We have a hell of a lot of work still to do. And, you know, there's discussions around truth recovery. There's discussions, you know, about a border poll. And
well, on that point of the border poll, is the time right now to call a border poll?
Yeah, Yeah, well, we're quite relaxed in terms of a border poll being called right now, because we actually believe it, that it should. Now, was that going to propel us into United Ireland? I don't think anybody within the Republican family believe that it will. But I think what it would do is generate that big conversation. You know, people talk about, you know, Sinn Féin in terms of our growth. The difference, for instance, you're talking about some armed groups that are there at the moment who are anti-peace process and an anti-political process. They have, some of them, been in existence for over 25 years and have tried to get themselves elected from 1986 onwards, and at different, you know, stages of it, you had different factions emerging as a result of initiatives that had taken place. And not one person has managed to garner the support of the electorate. And yep, and Sinn Féin stood for the first election, and people telling us, oh, you have no support out there. And we knew otherwise, because we were people who were living in the areas, working on the ground, knew what doors were opening and what support was actually there. And we got 54 people elected on the first go.
Could you convince enough people, though, to vote for United Ireland? You don't think that would happen if there was a border poll at the moment?
I think if a border poll, it would give you the measure of your political strength. And this is, I'm trying to, you know, when I was trying to say, we're very long-headed, very strategic. You know, and you take that and you build upon it and you work upon it and you use that.
Gerry Adams has sort of suggested that they would win a poll.
Well, I think there is a few that we certainly would. But whether we did or not, as I was saying, about being relaxed about it. You know, if we won a border poll, that opens up a conversation. If you didn't, it still opens up a conversation. And, you know, people start to, I think, look, this isn't about the fusion of the two states. This isn't about looking at the Irish constitution and in some way trying to have the people in the north living under the rules that govern Ireland as it's currently constituted. I think you'd need to be campaigning for a new agreed Irish constitution, you know, based on the separation of powers between the executive and the legislator and the judiciary, you know, which would be endorsed by the people. Like, the Irish constitution as it currently, as we know it, still has an article in it which recognises that women's place should be in the home. You know, and I was talking about that last week on International Women's Day. But when you're talking, when you're looking about, you know, how do we create a new Ireland where all of the people would have a few and would sit around the table and would exchange views around the form and the shape of that new Ireland, I think people from within the unionist tradition would be much more influential within that geographical setting as what they, you know, than what they are in Westminster. Absolutely, totally ignored all of the people here in the north when it comes to policy decisions or economic decisions, you know.
I'm sure unionists would probably disagree with that one, but Peter Robinson at the moment is trying to reach out to Catholic voters. That was your role in Sinn Féin when you were an ambassador to unionism. What do you think you achieved during your time?
Well, I got a couple of things, I would say, and I'm not trying to talk it up. I think there's still a lot of work for us as a party to do in this area. But the one thing that I had said when Gerry asked me to take on this role, we had been talking to many, many unionists for many, many years in close rooms. And I says that we needed to, I had a few that we needed to expose a lot of the conversations that had taken place. And I believe as a result of, you know, very public conversations and meetings that were held and were announced with, say, for instance, a lot of the different various church leaders, that it given, I mean this in a way because this is how it was described to me, so I'm only repeating it from someone from within the unionist tradition. She says to me that it gave her permission to engage because she was afraid to put her head above the parapet and to be seen to be engaging because she didn't know what was happening at any other level. And I think that in some places, and I think it's the same for ourselves, you have gatekeepers. Wherever one is trying to either prevent movement or not allowing people to get access into each other's space so that there can be quite basic just conversations taking place. And I think it allowed that. I was in places like Shankill. I've sat down with powerful individuals within the unionist tradition from particularly the working class area of unionism, different areas, and, you know, seen that there was so much common ground between ourselves and many people within the unionist tradition that, yes, we would have probably ended up with two different perspectives with regards to the constitutional question. But in the social and economic question, we have so much in common, like a hungry child going to, or a child without the proper shoes or the proper coat going to school in the Shankill, and the same in an area of the Falls. It doesn't matter, you know, what political affiliation you have or none. And therefore, you know, when you have three generations perhaps coming out of the same household that haven't had an opportunity to work, and I think within the unionist tradition that's biting in now in a way that maybe wasn't the case so much in the past, because there may have been an opportunity there through industry for the unionist tradition, working class unionist, to get jobs, and that's no longer the case.
But you
so
said
there that shared experience.
Yeah, you said there that there's a lot in common on social and economic issues, but you're in the OFM, DFM, and your counterpart there is Jonathan Bell.
Mm-hmm.
You must have serious disagreements on certain social issues.
Well, I have to say, Jonathan would probably smile if he was listening to me, because, you know, Jonathan, being a social worker for 21 years, has brought an understanding, I believe, to this role around those social economic issues, and has an understanding of what it's like for people who live in households that are struggling or who are at risk or who have not been given opportunities in life.
What about issues, though, like equality or gay rights? Do you clash over those kind of things?
Yeah, but Jonathan and I met, say, for instance, with the Rainbow Project, you know, and I understand that from the unionist, the DUP perspective, that they wouldn't be like ourselves with regards to trying to ensure that Section 75 applies to all. But they know as well as that they are dealing with a party who will never allow any one section of our community to be discriminated against in that way. So there are certain realities that each of us work with, with regards to each other's position and understand, and probably, you know, you have to respect where the other person has come from. You may not agree with them, fundamentally disagree with them, but you have to respect that that is what they have been elected on, and that's what they believe in, and that's what the voters have voted them in to do, and vice versa. And that's where you find, you know, and this is also part of the engagement process that I was involved in. It's the you know, they are to compromise, and that's inherent within the process of change. And I think that is something that we have brought to the table, and it's obviously something I think within the DUP in terms of working with ourselves that has been learnt by us all. And for instance, I remember Arlene Foster when she was DOE minister, and there was recent conversations again in the Assembly and elsewhere with regards to whether it should be 11 or 7 or 15 council model, and we preferred it would have been 7. We believed the 7 had was a fairer system, and there would have been more equality built into it. The DUP preferred 15, but we all compromised on 11.
Lately, there have been a lot of symbolic gestures from the leaders of unionism and republicanism. Peter Robinson has attended a GAA match, and Martin McGuinness has returned to Windsor Park. But the one thing that seems to still be a bit of a taboo is terminology. Why can't Sinn Féin, they work within the Northern Ireland Assembly, why can't they just say Northern Ireland?
Why can't you say the North? Why do you not ask why people can't say the North? Like, why
well, it's only because I'm talking to you now. I would ask Gregory Campbell the same thing next week.
Okay, well, but why aren't you relaxed about it? There's a terminology. Like, if I come from Derry, I come from the Bogside in Derry. Gregory, you mentioned, or Tanya, you come from Londonderry. That's okay. You know, why does people get hung up about it? That's how we identify with the area that you know, that we live in. That's how we view it. You know, I could say to you, well, look, you know, an artificially created state, how it was gerrymandered, you know, in terms of an artificial identity and all of that. And that's not how the unionists will view it. So why can people not understand? Look, this is my view and perspective and experience of where I lived. And as a consequence of that, this is what I call it. And, you know, but I have no problem in saying if I'm standing in Derry and I'm in a room where I can see people from the unionist tradition, I'm saying, well, look, you know, whether you call it Derry or whether Gregory calls it Londonderry, it's home.
Martina Anderson, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.